Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the consequences of General Michael Flynn and his son and other top members of the incoming Trump administration spreading fake news, which resulted in an attack on a Washington pizzeria popular with families and children by a supporter of family values who had a real gun and believed an online conspiracy theory Flynn and his son were peddling that Hillary Clinton was running a child sex trafficking ring out of the pizzeria. An internet and technology policy lawyer, Leslie Harris, the former president of the Center for Democracy and Technology, joins us to discuss what happened at her neighborhood pizzeria and the reckless and dangerous behavior of the next national security advisor, General Flynn, and his son. We'll also look into how Republican pressure on Facebook to get rid of supposedly biased human oversight and use algorithms instead led to the proliferation of fake news and a deluge of outrageous fabrications and hate speech aimed at the Clintons that helped elect Trump. Then we'll examine a Washington Post expose of how the Pentagon buried evidence of $125 billion in bureaucratic waste, so their next budget under the next administration will be laden with pork from a massive spending binge promised by Trump. Mandy Smithberger, the director of the Strauss Military Reform Program at POGO, the Project on Government Oversight, joins us to discuss how little outrage has been expressed in Washington as top Republicans with oversight, like Senator John McCain, ignore the report and plan to throw more money at the Pentagon. Then finally, we'll speak with Cleo Pascal, who is a Trudeau Fellow at the University of Montreal's Centre for International Studies and a Fellow at the Royal Institute of International Affairs, Chatham House, London. An expert on the geopolitical, security and economic consequences of environmental change from global warming, she joins us to discuss the possibility that Trump will choose the former head of Exxon as his Secretary of State at a time the oil giant is under investigation for actively suppressing evidence of the contribution to global warming from burning fossil fuels. And joining us now is Leslie Harris, who's an internet and technology policy lawyer who has been closely involved in the development of internet policy and regulation in Congress, the executive branch, the European Union, and global governance bodies, including the OECD, UNESCO, and ICANN. She is currently president of the Harris Strategy Group, a senior-level consultancy providing strategic advice on policy and strategy related to new technology, civil liberties, and human rights, and served as president and CEO of the Center for Democracy and Technology, a globally respected internet freedom organization working to keep the internet open, innovative, and free. Welcome to Background Briefing, Leslie Harris.
Thank you so much.
And in your neighborhood, I understand, in Washington, D.C., it's hard to believe that anybody would believe that Hillary Clinton was running a sex trafficking pedophilia ring out of a pizza parlor. But apparently this has gotten a lot of traction on the internet. A lot of this traffic has been encouraged and fed by the son of the incoming National Security Advisor, Michael Flynn's son, and it resulted in somebody driving up from North Carolina with a bunch of guns to shoot up the pizza place to liberate all of these imprisoned children that Hillary Clinton had imprisoned for her sex trafficking ring. Now, if you wrote this, I'm here calling you from Hollywood, right across the street from Universal Studios. If you wrote a script like this, that you'd be laughed out of the studio.
Yeah, you just took my line away from me. I'm listening to you describe this. And, of course, for me, it's like the work that I have done for years professionally suddenly sort of, transferring itself from sort of theoretical debates and online questions of free speech and censorship to a very real and very dangerous situation that's, you know, developed in my quiet little Northwest Washington neighborhood, all because the pizza place is, in fact, a beloved local institution where we have all taken our children, people take their grandchildren, and they have been under assault, death threats, obviously libel. They've had to take down their online ordering. And while this incident that happened Sunday was the first time somebody came in with an assault rifle, which I still can hardly say out loud. There have been incidents of people coming in and sort of stalking around with cameras, et cetera. So this has developed into a very dangerous situation for our community.
Well, the father and son, Michael Flynn, the incoming National Security Advisor, and which is an extremely important position, as needless to say, and his son, who is in the Trump transition, not entirely sure what his role is. But the son tweeted, until Pizzagate, and that's what they call this imaginary conspiracy that's getting all this traction online, until Pizzagate is proven to be false, it'll remain a story, he tweeted. The left seems to forget Podesta emails and the many coincidences tied to it. Of course, the Podesta emails came courtesy of Russian intelligence, and here's this character who's now the National Security Advisor going off to hang out with Putin on the Russians' dime.
Well, we are in an alternative. We are in an alternative universe. The universe of alleged fake news didn't begin with either of the Flynns. It began this particular story somewhere in the dark recesses of the internet. It gets picked up by some of the far right wing commentators and radio hosts. It led to the creation of a large subreddit on Reddit plotting what to do about this, and produced a whole host of people who now believe this story. It would be laughable, but in a world where we no longer agree that there are actual facts, it's become a very dangerous and perhaps, hopefully not, tragic situation. I don't know what to make of Michael Flynn. It seems to me that ought to be a bigger public story. But for my neighborhood, the question is, what role do we play in fighting back? Because, for many people, and we've had, the pizza place, Comet Pizza, has been full of customers. One way people have been fighting back is showing up. But a lot of people are afraid to move beyond that to anything where their name might be associated with it, because as soon as it is, then you get pulled into the conspiracy. Let me give you some background on Comet. I mean, imagine a street that has mostly local businesses, quiet neighborhood, progressive neighborhood. Interesting, because Michael Pence is moving into our neighborhood for 2 months before he moves into the vice president's mansion, and that's caused a bit of a stir. A pizza parlor with places for the kids to play ping pong, and on Sunday night, you'll trip over strollers. So, it has a lovely patio, wouldn't call it upscale. How could you imagine that this could possibly become tied into this crazy story? And it all comes, in fact, as you said, from the fact that Clinton's chief of staff knew the owner of the pizza parlor and had a discussion about a fundraiser. That's the best I can tell. And then these theories start to develop, that the symbol on the back of the pizza, on the back of the ping pong paddles is is some kind of satanic sign. And then it just builds and gets repeated and gets shared. And it's not just that this is false news. It's serious libel. It's threats to life and limb. It's destruction of a business. It's an entire neighborhood in fear.
Right, but when you've got AR-15 bullets being fired in your neighborhood with a guy that's got an assault rifle and a pistol and a shotgun in his car, who apparently believes this stuff,
he didn't start it. He's at the end of this chain of craziness.
Right. Right, but it's no longer a joke. Again, I'm speaking.
It's never a joke.
Right. Again, I'm speaking with Leslie Harris, who's an internet and technology policy lawyer, who's been closely involved in the development of internet policy and regulation.
And yet, I'm speaking to you as a concerned person in a neighborhood as an activist trying to help our neighborhood understand how to respond.
To the very worst that's come out of the internet. You know, the internet has amazing potential to educate and elevate us all, but in many ways it has become a kind of vehicle where so much is being said by so many about so little. That's bad enough in itself, how it's sort of fed a kind of Kardashian culture. But when you have conspiracy and violence mixed into this mix, and apparently an ill-educated country or a population, or at least a significant chunk of the population, that is the toxic mix we're dealing with, and that is apparently what has elevated Donald Trump to the presidency and the leader of the free world. So how do you undo that?
Well, I don't know how you undo that. You know, there are these proposals that all the platforms ought to be editing whatever news or posts go up on that site. And that's a debate that we had 20-something years ago and rejected that idea, and I think for good reason. The idea that Facebook ought to be able to pick and choose among what we as citizens are saying simply transfers the power as the ultimate arbiter of speech to whatever platform. I don't mean to be picking on Facebook. So, but we have given them the power as intermediaries while we protect them from liability. We've given them the power to take things down. So they do have the ability, although when you think about the number of things that are posted, to take things down. And I think that they try to do so. These kinds of stories, it is easy for them to be able to discern between fake news and not fake news. But I think we have to be very cautious to think about if we were to move to a world where they would be mandated to be the editors for the world. So I don't know that we have a very simple solution. And I think more importantly, while this may have some sharing on the sort of the big platforms we know about it, more of it happens in what I call the dark corners of the internet, and they're shared in places that we don't necessarily have access to, on alt-right sites, on alt-right radio. The only site, sort of legitimate site that had a lot of that had this big group put together was Reddit, and when they figured out what was going on, they took it down. But I'm not sure ultimately that that's the answer, nor am I very confident that sort of the traditional First Amendment remedies, bad speech is best cured by good speech, counter speech, works in a situation like this, because people aren't interested in facts.
But Donald Trump's national security advisor, General Flynn, when he was at the Defense Intelligence Agency, because he was given to so many wacky conspiracy theories, the staff at the DIA coined the phrase of Flynn facts.
Right.
And apparently his son has even taken this further in terms of conspiracy. But what bothers me is again, the Russian connection to this election has never been fully fleshed out. I mean, most of what Donald Trump's about was never fleshed out. His tax returns were never revealed. No reporter in this entire country asked him about why he didn't serve in Vietnam when they beat the hell out of Clinton about that, and George W. Bush as well.
Right.
So this is just appalling, the lack of the ability to get these people to even answer questions, let alone counter this blizzard of, it's called propaganda. Now, it's not a dirty word in Russia. Putin, ex-KGB officer, knows how to use propaganda, and he's doing it very well. He's got the entire country of Russia beguiled by the fact, here he is, one of the biggest thieves in history. Him and his friends are robbing the country blind, and yet he has an 80% popularity rating, largely due to his skill with propaganda. And the Chinese leader recently hauled in all of the top journalists in China and said, now your job from now on is propaganda. So
there is a difference. And I think that, right now, if I have a concern, it's that our breaks on this kind of propaganda have always been a combination of the press and the people. I mean, you know, the people in Russia are not getting the other side of the story. The people in China are not getting the other side of the story, and indeed confine themselves in jail along with the internet providers for allowing other voices to be heard. We don't live in that culture. One key question here is that we have to respond. And so many people are cowered and terrified, rightly so, by, you know, an incident like the one that's happening in my neighborhood, that it sort of frees the playing field for these kinds of comments to, to go from, you know, somebody's idea of a bad internet joke into a situation with somebody walking in with an assault rifle into a restaurant. So it seems to me that there are events like this one, and particularly having the national security advisor to be participating in it, that it's time for elected officials on both sides of the aisle to call that disqualified. Michael Flynn is not subject to any kind of approval by the Senate. So Donald Trump can do what he wants. But this is, you know, this is a time where leadership needs to be demonstrated across party lines to call this out, to say that this is, you know, not going to happen and that people participate in these things don't get to be rewarded by being the national security advisor. We have that right in this country, and it distinguishes us from Russia and China, and we have elected officials, including Republicans of goodwill, who ought to be standing up right now and saying, A, this is a false story, and B, participation in this story, apart from being wrong and evil, is libel. It's libelous. And see, you don't get the rewards of being part of an administration. And I haven't seen that happen. I don't know whether people don't understand how serious this is. I'd like to see the vice president who has moved into our neighborhood. That's part of the story that makes it particularly ironic, that Mike Pence is living in our neighborhood while he waits to move into the vice president's mansion. I'd like to see him step up and make a statement that this isn't true, come down the street with us and eat pizza. There's a lot of things that people who have the power to persuade the sort of people who follow these alt-right groups ought to be engaging in if they want to demonstrate that they are in the mainstream of American life and that they respect constitutional values.
But as much as there is a difference between the U.S. and Russia and China, that difference has been minimized by Rupert Murdoch, who brought a different kind of journalism to the United States with Fox News, which is largely the Pravda of the Republican Party. And I used to work in arms control in the Soviet Union, and many of the people that I dealt with were journalists for TASS and Pravda, and you felt kind of sorry for them because you knew that was their job to print propaganda. But here in the land of the free and the home of the brave, Murdoch's people at Fox willingly have become a mouthpiece. And in this case, they'll be the mouthpiece of a sitting government. Trump apparently gets his...
I'm afraid that's going to be Breitbart.
Well, I was about to say that. Trump, as we speak, he gets his information from Breitbart, from the Daily Caller, from Alex Jones's InfoWars, and from Fox News. That's his reality.
Right.
I mean, right. The president of the United States I'm talking about.
Right. I understand that, and I'm not saying that we're not headed to a very troubling time. But, you know, and I would like to see, you know, Alex Jones in particular, because InfoWars was a major distributor of this, pizza meme. I'd like to see them sued, and they may well be. I'd like to see them, some of these people, prosecuted for those, particularly people who are making threats. I mean, we have to fight back with the tools we have, and our tools are speech and rule of law. And we're headed into tough times, But we have, you know, but at least for those of us who still believe in the country that we have been living in all these years, or for somebody like me who's been a civil liberties and civil rights advocate all my life, you know, I'm going to turn to the tools I have, and I'm not going to, you know, I'm not suddenly going to either concede the space, nor am I going to turn around and decide, you know, to participate in, you know, left-wing fake news, of which there is far less. I think it's an interesting phenomena. So, what's going to be interesting is to see whether this Congress is going to sit quiet, and when our government, when decisions in our government are being dictated, you know, by fake news. I think it's going to be really interesting to watch, and I think that it's a time when people can no longer be bystanders, leaving it to the, you know, the experts or the advocacy groups to stand up. I think we all have to stand up, and we all have to speak truth to power, and it's a scary thing right now. I have done civil liberties-related work for 30 years, and I've received hate mail in my time. I've received some ugly things in boxes that I won't describe to you. But I've never felt that in the main that these were more than isolated incidents by individual crazy people. This is a weapon, weaponizing speech in a way that once you put it out there, you don't really know what the end result will be. And as I said, in this circumstance, the end result so far has been a man with an assault rifle in a quiet neighborhood. I think everybody, you know, this is not just going to be our concern. This is going to be everybody's.
And everybody's concern for the next 4 years has to be that the one job on this planet that requires the utmost realism, the absolute real-time information that could decide the fate of the world, the person who's sitting at that crossroads with literally next to the nuclear button, a man that we all depend upon for an understanding of what's happening in the real world, not in the world of imagination and conspiracy. This man is General Michael Flynn. He will be at that position, that critical role, which is the National Security Advisor, only one step away from the button. And this guy is, as former Secretary of State Colin Powell said, is a nut job. And we have to somehow get through these 4 years. So that's what bothers me and scares the hell out of me. And
it's a worthy thing to be worried about. Yeah. But you know, all I would say to your listeners is, we cannot sit by and just watch this. We have to participate. You know, we have to. You know, fake news has to be countered by real news. Hate has to be countered by love, and we just. You know, my deep in my soul, I want to, you know, get on a plane and go to a quiet corner of an island and sit it out. But I think that's not my job as an American.
Well, Leslie Harris, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Leslie Harris, who's an internet and technology policy lawyer who's been closely involved in the development of internet policy and regulation in the Congress, the executive branch, the European Union, and the global governance bodies, including the OECD, UNESCO, and ICANN. She served as president and CEO of the Center for Democracy and Technology, a globally respected internet freedom organization working to keep the internet open, innovative, and free. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back examining the Washington Post expose of how the Pentagon buried evidence of $125 billion in bureaucratic waste. Tell me, who's been, who's been you? Tell the
become your masters of war. You that build the big guns, you that build the death planes, you that build all the bombs, you that hide behind walls, you that hide behind discs.
I just don't want. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Mandy Smithberger, who's the director of the Strauss Military Reform Project at the Project on Government Oversight. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mandy Smithberger.
Thank you so much for having me.
And there was an amazing story in December the 5th, Washington Post, by Craig Whitlock and Bob Woodward. Pentagon buries evidence of a $125 billion in bureaucratic waste. So this is extraordinary. $125 billion a year, by the way, is probably more than the defense budgets of 90% of the countries on the planet. And yet, within the Pentagon itself, its own auditors have discovered that there's $125 billion in waste. And yet, the last thing they want is for this report to see the light of day. Is that a summary?
That appears to be the case of what happened. And something kind of ironic in this is that it took outside contractors to be able to do this analysis and identify $125 billion worth of savings.
And, of course, we're at a time where Donald Trump is planning on spending more on the military. His campaign theme was that we've let the military go to waste, that the generals are all complaining, and we've got to, you know, throw money at the Pentagon. And they're already wasting $125 billion. So is this going to have any effect? I mean, this has only been in the Washington Post. It should be a national story. It should have prompted congressional hearings. You're there in Washington. What's happening on the Hill? Any outrage?
You are seeing some outrage on the Hill. You've seen, for example, Republican Senator Jeff Flake has said that anyone who thinks that you can't identify wasteful spending in the Pentagon isn't paying attention. You've also seen criticisms from Democratic Senators Claire McCaskill, Ron Wyden, and Bernie Sanders, both on this waste, but also the inability of DOD to be able to pass an audit. Unfortunately, however, though, the two chairmen of the committees of jurisdiction on this issue, both Senator John McCain and Congressman Mac Thornberry, have looked at this report and said, no, we still think we need to increase spending.
So tell me about the actual money and where they found it. So let's start with the $125 billion. Is it sort of scattered all throughout this vast bureaucracy, or is there one particular driver, like, for example, the most outrageous boondoggle in history, the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter?
So that is a whole other area of waste that we've spoken about and could talk about separately, but this is really looking at what the Pentagon spends when it comes to services. So looking at what it spends on information technology and service contracting in particular, and some of the civilians who are overseeing the spending. And something that POGO has found in its own analysis is that in some cases, these service contractors can be as much as four times what a federal employee would cost.
Well, so are we to assume then that the waste and fraud is profit in the pockets of contractors? In other words, the taxpayer is not getting value for money, that $125 billion we're essentially overpaying.
It looks like in a number of these instances, we should be making better choices and evaluations about what the right workforce mix is. You know, how many federal employees we should have versus contractors and what's most effective.
So what about some of the former defense secretaries like Cohen and Gates and Hagel, et cetera? Has anybody joined in? If you've got John McCain and his House counterpart, you know, denying the reality that there's $125 billion in waste and yet they want to throw more money at the Pentagon, rather than save $125 billion and put it to work wisely, is there any organization forming, any kind of critical mass of former secretaries of defense, et cetera, stepping up here and just saying this is a national disgrace and has to be dealt with?
I have not seen any comments
when it comes to this story in particular, but both Senator Gates and Senator Hagel have looked for opportunities for savings. I think pretty much as soon as you come into the Pentagon, you identify that there are inefficiencies there and that some of the procedural hurdles to get things done aren't really making things more effective. What's always difficult, though, is you want to make sure that for taxpayers you have enough people overseeing the spending and that you're not just kind of shoveling the money out the door. Both under the Clinton administration and the Bush administration, we saw a huge increase in contractor spending without really having enough federal employees to oversee all of that spending.
Well, that's basically across the board has become one of the biggest rackets in Washington, D.C., leading some people to describe our nation's capital as Nigeria on the Potomac, this phenomenon of contractors, which has, you know, added to the defense budget enormously, added to the intelligence budget. We've seen how one of the intelligence contractors, Booz Allen Hamilton, has been giving away the store of secrets via Edward Snowden and this other fellow that they have arrested. So we're certainly not getting our value for money. So that's a big part of it, right, this contracting racket.
Absolutely. It's about spending and making sure that we have proper control over information and proper security of it. Some of what you're referring to are things that we refer to as inherently governmental functions, where we think it's something that really, and under law, we really think it's something that has to be performed by a federal employee.
But it's not performed by a federal employee. And in fact, the worst of it is that, for example, in the intelligence world, these contractors can hire CIA people, for example, who the government has spent a lot of money on training, and then lure them away and pay them, you know, lure them away by offering two or three times their salary. And then they get to bill the salary back to the government, you know, sometimes at 10 or 20 times what they're paying for. This is allowed under the rules. We know that from what they paid Edward Snowden.
No, absolutely. You see a lot of out-of-control spending in this area.
So, again, I'm sort of hoping that there's going to be some hearings on this. What do we know about there will be hearings, of course, for the new Secretary of Defense, General Mad Dog Mattis. Is this likely to be a part of the hearings? Because have you looked into his involvement with the defense contractor Theranos?
We have. We've been following that and his current position as a board member for General Dynamics, which is one of the top contractors for the Department of Defense. Mm-hmm. And I think in addition to concerns about what is the right top line and how do we have appropriate priorities to make sure that we do have a strong national security, but that we're also good stewards of taxpayer dollars, there should be questions asked about his potential conflicts of interest and his behavior advocating for companies. In the case of Theranos, we know that he received an ethics opinion telling him that he should not be representing the company before the department. Some might reasonably question why he then chose to join the board of that company after receiving that ethics advice.
So what is the sort of smoke there in terms of whether or not there's fire? There's certainly been questions raised about his ethical judgment, General Mattis, in terms of both Theranos and General Dynamics.
So unfortunately, we have not seen much from General Mattis himself as to why he made these decisions. And so we're looking forward to the confirmation hearing, providing him the opportunity to respond to these allegations and to see if he still considers his actions on behalf of these companies to be correct and really what we want to see our public servants do after they leave federal service.
Right, but the problem with Washington, which you've just identified, is that people trade in their public service for private gain, and it's known as the revolving door. And in this case, the door revolved pretty quickly with General Mattis, where he went to work for these big contractors and apparently got paid a fortune, and he was flagged and warned that there were some ethical problems with his position. And, you know, obviously we'll wait to hear about that from the confirmation. But in general, is this going to be the man that's going to clean up this mess? Because isn't this at the heart of the problem, is that the contractors are able to basically get the people on the inside, either the ones that are active on the inside, they manage to sort of roll over them and just keep overcharging and overcharging and overcharging. And we know from the officer that was put in charge of the F-35, they had him on 60 Minutes saying, "I'm really going to stop this waste and fraud." he didn't stop a damn thing. So we know that the system doesn't work. But when you have these retired generals being able to sort of sit on the boards, you know, that sort of sounds like double dipping. And one of the reasons for this hearing is that this Congress has to give a waiver to General Mattis because he hasn't been out of the military for 7 years, which is the current law.
Correct. So I agree completely that the revolving door between military officers and Pentagon officials and the contractors they're supposed to be overseeing is corrosive. You know, the best case scenario is it creates the appearance of a conflict of interest. In many instances, we've seen it creates an actual conflict of interest. In addition to General Mattis, we saw General Cartwright, who advocated for saving the blimp that everyone saw got loose, and then seemed to be rewarded for his advocacy with a board position afterwards.
So at this point, one of the things that concerns me is that Donald Trump has, that his campaign promises to drain the swamp are the opposite to ladling in more pork. I mean, which is what essentially, if there's $125 billion already being wasted, it's spending one dime more doesn't make any sense. And they're talking about spending hundreds of billions more on our defenses because they made this charge that somehow we're a second-rate power and the generals are all alarmed and the Obama and company don't know what they're doing. That's the charge that Trump made. What's your sense? Is the defense budget going to go up?
It appears likely the defense budget is going to go up, but we really think that it shouldn't, and that by continuing to throw more money at the Pentagon, it's going to be the same business as usual that delivers us weapon systems that underperform, that are overcost, that arrive far too late. And until you have really meaningful ethical restrictions on these officials to prevent them from going through the revolving door and having public disclosure of all of those ethics opinions, that you're really going to continue to see these problems occur.
Well, one of the things that bothers me is, I mean, first of all, you probably don't need to justify defense spending because, after all, you know, the Pentagon or the military has not won a war since World War II. I mean, Vietnam, Korea, you name it, the list goes on, Iraq, Afghanistan. To this day, we have not won a war. But the defense budget continues to go up. And even when the Soviet Union collapsed, there wasn't a peace dividend. And we spend more now than we did at the height of the Cold War. So apparently we don't need an enemy. That's just an unfortunate reality. But they do like to invent an enemy. And what I'm concerned about is that when Donald Trump made his ill-advised phone call to the leader of Taiwan, guess who was in the room with him at Trump Tower? None other than John Bolton, this neocon who could possibly be the Secretary of State. There is a rumor that the neocons who are coming back with Trump want to gin up a war arms race with China, because China is the only one that we can have a really good arms race with. So is that somewhere on your radar, that may be the next step in order to justify this massive military buildup over nothing? They will gin up an arms race with China?
We're always concerned about threat inflation and efforts to try and scare Americans into increasing spending without really looking meaningfully at what would enhance our national security.
Well, Mandy Smith-Berger, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And again, I've been speaking with Mandy Smith-Berger, who's the director of the Strauss Military Reform Project at the Project on Government Oversight. We're going to take a brief station break and back discussing how Trump might choose the former head of Exxon as his Secretary of State.
Oh, no. Oh, well, I ain't going to study war no more. Ain't going to study war no more. Ain't going to study war no more.
study. Oh, no more, yes, I won't no more. Well, I ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more. Gonna lay down my hymn book down by the riverside. Down by.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Cleo Pascal, who's the Sunday Guardian's North American Special Correspondent, who specializes in geopolitical, security, and economic implications of environmental change from global warming. She is a visiting Trudeau Fellow at the University of Montreal's Centre for International Studies and a Fellow at the Royal Institute of International Affairs, Chatham House, London, as well as a consultant to the U.S. Department of Energy, NATO, and the OSCE. And she is the author of Global Warring, How Environmental, Economic, and Political Crises Will Redraw the World Map. And her latest article at The Guardian is Oceania is Changing Fast and India Will Be Affected. Welcome to Background Briefing, Cleo Pascal.
Always a pleasure.
Well, thank you, Cleo. And there was a very strange meeting yesterday at Trump Tower with Al Gore and Donald Trump and his daughter Ivanka. And, of course, Donald Trump, while talking to the leading exponent of the need to deal urgently with global warming, Al Gore, is also has on his transition team for the EPA, a global warming denier, and on his transition team for the Department of Energy, a person who's extremely hostile to green energy and renewables. So mixed signals, to say the least. He's also apparently considering Rex Tillerson, the former CEO of Exxon, as his next Secretary of State. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I mean, as you said, there are a lot of mixed signals. Also, at the same time, his golf course in Scotland has had a planning application in to put in a seawall to prevent against the effects of rising sea levels and increasing storm activity. So he knows that there is an infrastructure impact from climate change. And I think his daughter, she's a New Yorker who, by her own admission, could have gone with either party. She calls herself a millennial who, you know, doesn't stick to labels. So I think he has at his very core some people who are extremely aware of the issue, and he himself is aware of the business implications of not handling the problem. So I think it's kind of a wait-and-see sort of situation. But I know Ivanka will be around for all of the 4 years. I'm not sure his other appointments will be.
So you're not too worried then? I mean, it would seem to me that given the urgency to deal with global warming, because we're reaching a point where the cycle is self-reinforcing and it gets exponentially worse, we can't even afford a caretaker. We can't even afford to stand still. We have to have somebody that's proactive.
Yeah, I mean, the situation is definitely not ideal. And I think a lot of the burden will probably fall to the states. So I would expect leadership, for example, from California on dealing with some of the emissions issues. But when you're talking about the science behind it, there are several different areas where actions can be taken. So we're talking mostly in terms of the problems in his cabinet about mitigation issues, about emissions issues. But if he's putting in infrastructure, for example, the infrastructure, if it's properly planned, can help substantially with adaptation. So given that, you know, this is the situation, he's the president-elect and these are the people who are around him, you know, you push on the doors that are more likely to open and help build up in the other sectors where, like, for example, if you're looking at emissions trading, you'd look at California, you wouldn't necessarily look at the federal government. So it's a complex situation where there are a million different problems and a million different solutions, and some of the solutions we definitely won't get. But, you know, work towards building up some of the solutions that are a little bit more likely. And then as the impacts become more clear, this invariably happens, people start to say, why am I spending this much to protect the coastline when actually it's a much better business deal to stop the problem from happening to the degree that we can in the first place?
But, of course, having a former head of Exxon as Secretary of State is puzzling on the surface, but it's particularly peculiar, particularly now that a federal judge in Texas has granted permission to Exxon to question under oath the attorney generals of Massachusetts and New York to look into the investigation of ExxonMobil and have the attorneys for ExxonMobil be able to literally question the attorney generals about the extent of their investigation and find out what they know about ExxonMobil's role in global warming denial over the years. And essentially, it's a lot of legal scholars are absolutely alarmed at this prospect, where a corporation could investigate the investigators, law enforcement investigators, to find out what they know about their misdeeds.
Yeah, it is incredibly problematic, and hopefully it won't stand. If it does stand, it has the potential to be as disruptive as the Citizens United ruling. Like, it's a real problem. It isn't over yet. Hopefully, on appeal, it'll be struck down. But there's going to be a lot of fights on a lot of fronts. And with the concern that things might be going awry, hopefully more people will get involved in the areas where they think they can make a difference and move forward from there. It's going to be the issues related to environmental change are multiple, and people need to look around their own communities, figure out what they should be doing to build up resilience and reduce impacts in many, many different areas. So not just climate change, but, for example, groundwater depletion, which is a huge problem in the Western United States. So hopefully, when the problems become headlines like they do now, people will realize they can't just sit back and do nothing. They need to take responsibility in their own areas for doing what they can to ensure that we're going forward into a more stable future.
So let's broaden the conversation out a little, Cleo, to what a possible Trump foreign policy might mean. We know that Trump has said that he's going to, among the many things, particularly Obama's signature Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, that he's going to kill that off as soon as possible. He's also said he's going to kill off the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, that is at the heart of President Obama's pivot to Asia. As you know, Obama has recognized the folly of empire in the U.S.'s misadventures in the Middle East and wants to stop throwing good money after bad and the lives of young Americans in this quagmire in the deserts of Iraq and Syria, etc., which is unfortunately something he's tried to get out of, but he can't really get out of it. But he has tried to engineer a way to contain China through organizing the neighbors who are alarmed at China's aggressive moves, particularly in the South China Sea. So while the anti-TPP people are on the left, they're very active, and on the right, they're the isolationists. So you have a pretty strong coalition against it. It's as dead as a dodo. But what's your sense of the strategic implications of abandoning TPP?
It's a complex issue. The deal, as it sort of ended up, was not an ideal deal. So it was conceptualized as 21st century geopolitics, as a kind of coming together of like-minded, mostly democratic countries to create a trading bloc that would help countries in the Asian region withstand trade pressure from China. But once the trade negotiators got through with it, it became a very 20th century sort of almost neoliberal trade pact, which may have caused a lot of problems for countries in the region, especially around things like pharmaceutical costs. So there were, and intellectual property, all that sort of stuff. So there were which is why a lot of people on the left were protesting it, including on, you know, on the floor at the DNC. It was a really serious issue. So that's not, wasn't an ideal deal. And the question now is whether Trump's going to go in with a series of bilateral relationships with countries in the region or try to build up some other form of coalition, which is based on economic and democratic compatibilities. The move to engage with Taiwan was a really, really interesting move. That might reassure some of the other countries in the region, including, for example, South Korea and Japan. But he seems to be very much focused on bilateral relationships. And he would need to reassure Australia, for example, and as well as, you know, Indonesia, many other countries, that in the case of a crisis in the Pacific Ocean, the U.S. would come to the aid of its allies. That has always been a question. That's why Japan, for example, has been doing heavy outreach to India. And that's also why the U.S., under President Obama, has been building up India. The Pentagon's only country-specific dedicated unit is the Indian unit, and that's for accelerating arms sales and military cooperation with India, not because of India in the Indian Ocean, but because of India in the Pacific Ocean. So if he doesn't reassure his partners that the U.S. will militarily defend them in the time of crisis, then the fallback position is to embolden the allies in the region and help equip them to think that they'll be able to defend themselves against China if China becomes more aggressive. So I don't know which route, if any, of those two options are going to be taken on. The tweets about China were remarkable and I think will make a lot of skittish allies in the region take notice. And the outreach to Taiwan, if it continues, is extremely important, especially for kind of the positioning in the first island chain and out to the second island chain. So it's, again, a situation where people are watching very, very closely because it could go in one of myriad directions. But it's definitely moving. This is not the Obama policy in the region. And it's we're sort of trying to read the tea leaves as he puts together his cabinet and tweets at 3 a.m. about what the policy is.
Right, but I detect a certain assumption on your part that there is a strategy behind what Trump is doing. And one of the great fears that, that many have here in the United States is that there is no strategy. There's no knowledge. There's no interest. There's no background. There are just impulses at 3 a.m. to tweet things out. And more alarmingly, there's no adult supervision. General Flynn, his national security advisor, and his son have been involved in putting out fake stories that Hillary Clinton has been running a child sex trafficking ring out of a pizzeria in Washington, D.C., that prompted a young man from North Carolina to shoot the place up. That's the sort of level of some of the people. Former Secretary of State Colin Powell described General Flynn as a nut job. Can you assume that there's some strategy in that administration that seems to be so bereft of strategic thinkers?
Well, Donald Trump, President-elect Donald Trump, has a very strong personality, and strategy grows out of personality. And so I think a lot of people are looking at what his personality is like, which is, you know, he's a fighter and he doesn't back down, and extrapolating a foreign policy from that. The other thing is that, you know, there are a million employees in the United States government, and there's a lot of inertia in those systems and a lot of extremely smart people in those systems as well. The concerning thing for me is that I heard that he's turning away the presidential briefs, right? The daily presidential briefs. If that's the case, then that is concerning. But he has a kind of top layer of advisors, which are ones that are being announced. And then there's sort of a whole other layer of people that are involved, including a lot of Indo-Americans. You know, he established very strong relationships with the Indo-American community during the campaign. And, you know, they're very knowledgeable about their region. I don't know whether he has a kind of similar depth of expertise for the Pacific, but I can't, that Taiwan call didn't happen by accident. That would have been set up very carefully over a long period of time, and it indicates a new direction. So I don't know what it means. We're just seeing pieces of the jigsaw puzzle. But given the consistency of his behavior and the consistency of his personality, I don't think it's going to veer all over the map. I think we just don't have all the pieces of the jigsaw puzzle in place yet.
But how do you think Indo-Americans feel about the transcripts that the Pakistanis released of the conversation that Donald Trump had with the Prime Minister of Pakistan, which was just, it almost ran out of adjectives. You're fabulous. Your country's fabulous. You're a great guy. You're doing a great job. I can't wait to visit your country, etc. I mean, that had to, unless it's just pure sort of, you know, salesmanship, then that had to alarm the Indians, surely.
If I was the president and I had a good relationship with India and I was, you know, talking to them regularly, I would not worry about making a phone call like that, because the Indians would know exactly what you're doing, which is trying to not set off alarm bells. But, you know, again, I don't know. Like, you know, it's not inconsistent with a well thought out strategy. And again, I have to assume, because things like the Taiwan call are such a big deal, that he has a serious team somewhere in there. It might not be what you're seeing out front, but you know, the pattern is starting to develop. If we had you know, a talk again in 2 months, we'd have much more of the picture. But I'm not concerned about that. I'm not concerned about that call to Pakistan, because, you know, if you were trying to develop a relationship with India and you wanted to lower the tension around it, that's exactly what you'd do.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Cleo Pascal. And I must say that this is one of the more optimistic conversations I've had about a Trump foreign policy. Yeah. I don't know whether you're being charitable or insightful. So I guess we'll find out, right?
Yeah, we will. Yeah, and you know, also don't underestimate the depth of knowledge and commitment and real understanding of this country within the system in Washington, within the civil service.
Exactly. You know, if he chooses to listen to them, and so far he's not taking the daily intelligence brief. Yeah. So we'll see.
Yeah.
Again, thank you, Cleo. I appreciate your time.
Always a pleasure. Thanks.
Thank you. Bye bye. And again, I've been speaking with Cleo Pascal, who's a Sunday Guardian's North American special correspondent who specializes in the geopolitical, security, and economic implications of environmental change from global warming. She is a visiting Trudeau Fellow at the University of Montreal Centre for International Studies and a Fellow at the Royal Institute for International Affairs, Chatham House, London, as well as a consultant to the US Department of Energy, NATO, and the OSCE, and is the author of Global Warring: How Environmental, Economic, and Political Crises Will Redraw the Map. And her latest article at The Guardian is Oceania is Changing Fast and India Will Be Affected. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcast. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.